All right, hello everybody in Blogging Heads Nation. This is Eli Lake, and I am joined today with Spencer Ackerman, who I've known for a very long time. And because Obama won, I'm playing a special song for you, Spencer. Todd Rundgren just won victory.
Oh! The NASDAQ!
Which I thought was kind of appropriate for the Democrats.
Well done,
and it will be an inspirational song for the Republicans, I think, in a few years. So just mellowing out. Right, how are you today, Spencer?
I'm not bad, Eli, and if I may, let me welcome everyone
to a special reconciliation episode
with Walking Heads.
This is the what? Say it again. Reconciliation, yes.
The reconciliation.
It is. So this is the reconciliation.
Would you like to explain that, my friend?
There's a lot of beef. It's like a, because it's like we're the Montagues and the Capulets, the Sharks and the Jets. Different crews, you know? But Spencer and I, we've been known each other since 2002.
That's right. It's been a while.
And then there was a period, and I think, you know, heated passions on both sides. There's a lot of water there, and there's a lot of disagreement, but it's a new era. So let's talk about Obama. And we said on the emails that we weren't going to get too into the personal stuff, right?
That's right.
Okay. All right. Very good. All right. But there's a series of policy and political and disagreements, and I think it's fair to say that some of my friends have and your friends don't get along. Is that right?
Yeah, that's right.
I think that's fair. Okay. All right. So let's. But that doesn't stop the dialogue at Blogging Heads TV. So let's start off. Dueling theories of an Obama doctrine, right?
Sure. I wrote a piece in March, I believe, for the American Prospect.
Yes.
that attempted to explicate through extensive interviews with Obama's foreign policy inner circle, at least during the campaign. What it was that he will seek to do as commander in chief, as an Obama administration moves forward, and what I found increasingly was that there wasn't simply going to be an argument made about the Iraq War or about the war on terrorism, about Afghanistan. There would be an argument about the way that foreign policy would be discussed in the United States and discussed in terms of politics. And the way that I found that the Obama people kept talking about it was about removing the politics of fear, by which they meant a kind of stifling of the discussion on foreign policy based on an attempt to intimate that your opponents, particularly, you know, on the right coming to the left, were somehow deficient in terms of patriotism, in terms of hard-headedness, and in terms of what, you know, we in the blogosphere like to make fun of, seriousness. And so I'll be interested to see how, or whether even, an Obama administration successfully does, in fact, change that debate. And then there were some issues about specifics that the Obama people talk a lot about, and from, I think, our perspective, the ones that you and I are most concerned about have to do with terrorism, have to do with counterinsurgency, and have to do with the theaters of Iraq and then Afghanistan. Is that fair to say?
Yeah. Can we go back to the politics of fear?
Go back to the politics of fear.
Yes, the left plays its own politics of fear. I mean, for example, there have been countless articles suggesting or saying that someone has insider knowledge that Dick Cheney is about to bomb Iran personally. And these have all been sort of proven false, and they're all sort of based on these rumors. And, or example, for example, the Lawrence Wilkerson theory or narrative about a cabal taking over the government. And then in the extreme cases, I'm not saying you do this, but certainly Juan Cole is an example of somebody who has literally said that there, you know, were Likudniks, you know, and people who are more loyal to Israel, who use the Pentagon, as in his words, as a Gurkha, like Gurkhas for American soldiers to fight Israeli wars. This is a fairly ugly politics that I've detected from the left that I think also in some ways plays upon the fear that you know, the democracy is no longer accountable and is sort of taken over by secretive Camarillas and so forth.
I mean, I don't really see that as being comparable to whisper campaigns that Barack Obama is a Muslim and that in turn entails his lack of loyalty to the United States. When you see email campaigns forwarded around the state of Pennsylvania or pamphlets floated around the state of Pennsylvania that Barack Obama will mean a second Holocaust. Obnoxious commentary in the blogosphere is one thing.
Nasty sub-Rosa stuff, no doubt.
Yeah.
The Ask Me Union flyers
about McConnell, which was really, really loathsome and beyond the pale, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. No, I mean, there are nasty things, and I certainly would join you in saying that those kinds of anonymous emails, some of which, by the way, cropped up, as you know, during the primary and were likely the knife work of maybe indirectly Sidney Blumenthal. But, I mean, I don't actually know that, but one would suspect.
Sure. I guess if the broader point is that the right wing doesn't have a monopoly on a smear campaign, that certainly stands as a valid point.
But I'm saying that there is, but then there's like a somewhat legitimate thing, which is sort of, you know, I think that there has been a fierce debate about the American national interest in the last, you know, 5 years or so. And that debate about the national interest on both sides can be a debate sometimes where one could say someone's patriotism is questioned. After all the things that, you know, you and others have been writing about Doug Feith were true, then you would have to say that the guy really wasn't a patriot at all, right? I mean, he was a heinous villain.
To a degree,
I think it's sort of where you sit is where you stand. I certainly think that the left has played a politics of fear, though to Obama, to his credit, when he speaks personally, at least, not necessarily his operation, has avoided some of the more strident rhetoric that I would associate with others. Like, I mean, certainly he hasn't kind of sunk to the depths of like a John Edwards on these things. I mean, in part because he didn't vote for the war. I mean, he was a legislator in Chicago.
I would defy you to point to one thing that I've written that questions Doug Feith's patriotism.
Questioning his patriotism, but I'm saying that if Doug Feith is
No. You accused me of something, and I'm going to respond to it. What I'm going to say is, as you've seen in everything I've written, you can go after someone's wisdom, someone's competence, and someone's inadequate, or I would argue, inadequate understanding of the national interest and the proper role of American foreign policy in issues X through Z without questioning their patriotism. That's what I do. I don't appreciate you saying that I've done something otherwise. And
well, you've said that Doug Feith is responsible for pressuring analysts and inventing intelligence for the Office of Special Plans, which I don't think there's much evidence for. But that said, the argument about the pre-war intelligence, which is a serious one, that if these allegations were true, then these people were undermining the national interest. You should question their patriotism. If it's true that Doug Feith was responsible for lying America into a war, like with phony intelligence, when all the other analysts were saying otherwise, then that is like a profound act of villainy, right?
What you're saying simply doesn't follow. What one can do perfectly is pursue a policy end contrary to the facts, contrary to the evidence, in order to bring about one's desired policy goals and still have a perfectly robust view of patriotism. And it just simply doesn't follow what you're saying. So I think it's probably best to move to another topic.
If the Iraq war went down as you and others have said it did, which is the deliberate tampering of evidence and pressuring of analysis to lie effectively to Congress, the American people, and the UN Security Council, then that is a profound act of, I mean, that would count as an act against a crime against the nation. I mean, saying that the charge itself is so loaded. I guess maybe my issue here is that I don't think that's what happened, but that would lead one to, as I said earlier, Spencer, you did not, as others had, question, you know, say that Doug Feith was, you know, really a Likudnik or whatever. I mean, that, which is a separate matter. which is, I think, a direct challenge to his patriotism. It's saying that he's more loyal to Israel, as Juan Cole has.
This is really, really, really a pointless and irrelevant discussion, and I was hoping that we wouldn't...
All right, well, we can move on. I'm happy to move on. It's if you don't want to talk about it, it's fine. But I'm saying you bring up the sort of politics of fear, and I'm sort of, as somebody, you know, somewhat has a different perspective on these things, I think the left has employed their own politics of fear in the last 5 years.
And 10 minutes ago, I conceded that point. So
okay, all right.
Doing this is foolish. And
all right, well, let's move on to the Obama document.
So what do you think of when you see an when you look at the last couple months of debate over Iraq, over Afghanistan and Pakistan, and in terms of the war on terror more broadly, what conclusions does that lead you to? What are you looking at in terms of what will be important from your perspective for the first couple actions that the Obama people take?
Well, I mean, I first of all can't predict. I think in an email we had related to a story I wrote about the Syria stuff that just happened about 2 weeks ago. I made the point, and I think you would agree, that most presidents react to the world as it is. I mean, we wouldn't have predicted, well, maybe some people would have predicted, but, you know, on the day after the victory of Obama, you know, the Russians just declared that they were going to place, I guess, a nuclear-tipped missiles, you know, at the edge of Eastern Europe. That could be a foreign policy crisis if they go through with these plans.
Mm-hmm. So that would be issue number one that you'd be looking at.
That's something that just happened that I don't know that there's much in the campaign rhetoric or the rather considered and deliberate positions that Obama has taken, mm-hmm. took during the campaign about the war on terror and other things. I don't know that there's something that we can sort of find from that. He's got to react to these events. We don't know if they're bluffing. I mean, there's a whole lot of things that are going to happen with that to determine. So that's my first caveat. I think you would agree that the President of the United States is not, you know, very rarely do you have, like, you know, a guy campaigning saying, this is what I'm going to do with the world, and then it actually, like, turns out exactly as he says.
Certainly.
More often than not, you have an example of Bush who says, we're not going to be the world's 9-1-1, involved in nation building in Iraq and Afghanistan, or, for that matter, you know, Clinton campaigning in some ways as a Tiananmen China hawk, you know, opening up, you know, the most robust trade relations we've ever had with China. So, I mean, you have examples of presidential campaigns often disconnected from how presidents actually govern and what their foreign policy is, because in many ways, the president will have to react to the world as it is. That's just my first caveat on that. But, you know, I guess the second thing is that it looks like, from my perspective, on the key issues that animated the Obama campaign in the primary, he did seem to move a little bit away from it during the general election. I mean, would you agree with that?
Well, let's instantiate that. Because do you mean Iraq in particular?
Yeah, I think in Iraq, I detected a softening of the position during the general, where, you know, he did not emphasize as much his plan to kind of remove all the troops, and now I think has come around to what I think is the sensible position that I think left and right on Iraq now agree on, which is that it should be. Then whatever happens to the presence of American troops in Iraq should be negotiated with the Iraqi government. So, assuming that Maliki is genuine when he says he'd like all the troops to leave by a certain date, I guess in 2010, which you know I could argue that both ways. I guess I'd say that, you know, in that respect, you know, Obama is pretty much where at least I would be. Like, I mean, I think that a status of forces agreement should govern the presence of troops. That was my position in 2006 and 2007, and I don't think it was the position of many of Obama's supporters, and I don't think it was Obama's position in those years. And then he's moved to this position of basically agreeing that it should be negotiated.
Well, I think that's generally true. I'd offer just a few factual caveats on that. One, there didn't seem to be much discussion of the status of forces agreement in the campaign, likely because it was an esoteric issue. Though you and I would I believe definitely agree that it's important. Let me secondly say that I agree with that position that you just laid out entirely. That if what will be important and will ultimately govern the U.S. continued relationship with Iraq is going to be negotiated between the U.S. and the Iraqi governments. That's as it should be. Second, and thirdly, Obama in January of 2008 sent a letter to Bush about the Status of Forces Agreement, outlining certain things that he found unacceptable and insisting that – I'm sorry, this is January 2007. No, I'm wrong. Obviously, it's 2008. Sorry. Anyway, in January 2008, saying that there would be certain things he found that would be unacceptable. One paramount one would be the presence of permanent military installations there. And this is back when Bush was saying, after the fall of 2007, when this declaration of principles that led to the Status of Forces Agreement was going around, that he wasn't going to negotiate with Congress, that this would be a kind of plenary authority for him to negotiate this sort of stuff. And we also thought it was going to be something that governed the presence of U.S. forces in Iraq for an indefinite period. And what ended up happening with the relationship in terms of the Status of Forces Agreement with Iraq, I would contend was kind of a blunder on the Bush administration's part. They didn't intend for Maliki to actually bring forward this sort of new assertiveness that people frequently talk about him having, and insisting that there would be a firm timetable for withdrawal that the Bush administration ended up having little choice but to acquiesce to. So as the SOFA negotiations basically moved toward, I would argue, Obama's position as Maliki expressed in July, There's really only one position that I would consider Obama, when he inherits the Status of Forces Agreement, will really be sort of moving away from his own position from, and that's that the final date of withdrawal, according to the current text, says that it just has to occur before December 31st, 2011, which is, I guess, a year beyond his 16-month timetable. What's interesting about that Status of Forces Agreement is that, according to the last round of reporting about this, the Iraqis have not only made that position much, much firmer, but they've also gone beyond where Obama was. Obama, you'll remember, throughout the campaign, only talked about removing combat troops from Iraq. He always said, from 2007 on, this was a bone of contention between him and the left, that he would want to leave 30,000 mostly non-combat troops in Iraq as a residual presence. Their position in Iraq being more or less indefinite for counterterrorism purposes, for training purposes, for advisory purposes. Basically, it's like a backstop against like disaster breaking out. And now the Iraqi government is basically saying that's unacceptable. They're going way beyond that and saying by December 31st, 2011, at the latest, all American forces have to be out. So that's all I'd caveat.
Well, I mean, this is based largely, I think, on the draft from that, as I've been told, is the Salah Mutlak draft. Mm. And he's a sort of Sunni politician who has, long ties to the CIA and kind of disappointed, I think, a lot of disappointed the American side in his ability to actually rein in, or at least he claimed to be able to rein in some of the Sunni nationalist terrorism. The awakening leadership, which is probably going to do fairly well when the provincial elections happen early next year, has taken a very fairly different view. I would imagine that they would have some role in any negotiation on a SOFA after those provincial elections. And my sense of it is that the real point of contention behind the scenes is the status of Shawani's intelligence service, that Sunni kind of death squad.
Why don't we just explain who Mohammed Shawani is?
Yes, Mohammed Shawani told the CIA in 1995 that he had a cell at the highest levels of the Ba'ath Party and is responsible for a great intelligence blunder whereby radio equipment was smuggled in from an Egyptian who was a double agent working in factories. So anyway, the point is that Shawani's cell, including some of his own sons, were slaughtered literally on a communication device that went back to the CIA station in Amman. And, since then, after the 2003 invasion, he has emerged as kind of the custodian of an intelligence service that doesn't report to the Iraqi National Assembly and doesn't report to the Shia-led government, and largely now reports to MNFI, Multinational Forces Iraq. And my understanding is that this intelligence service, is widely kind of the proxy, against the Iranian network in Iraq, and is and Maliki and the Shia leadership for their own reasons, not, I think, for Iranian reasons, but for their own reasons, have been trying to get rid of it for some time. And that's been a really, that's, I think that's been a really sensitive issue that has gotten less ink recently. Yeah. And also, you know, that, you know, I think that there is something to be said, which is that if Iraq is to be an independent nation and a democratic nation, then they ought to have one security service that's accountable to the political leadership. And this is clearly not. I mean, would you agree with all that?
I would agree with all that. The only thing I'd add to it is that first, well, two things I'd add to it, and they're both minor. First, Shawani is basically paid by the CIA, or at least was until my understanding is 2006.
He is paid by the CIA. Yeah.
And if he still is, I don't know that. I know that he was paid up until 2006.
Right.
And then secondly, to just flesh out what you said a bit more about the Iraqis and Maliki in particular desiring, you know, single control, you know, chains of command security networks, there's a perception, particularly among Shiite Iraqis, that if Shawani's network remains intact as it is, kind of bureaucratically outside the full control of the Iraqi government, that it's basically a backdoor way of continued American influence, if not control. So that's one of the reasons that they want it, you know, gotten either incorporated, you know, fully within the chain of command, you know, stretching from Maliki to the Ministry of Interior, or dismantled.
Right. I actually am fairly sympathetic to the Iraqi state for that, though. My understanding is the argument from the American side is that, you know, eventually they'd like to get rid of the Shawani Security Service. However, for now, it does provide a valuable service in rolling up the Iranian network in Iraq, and it's something that they did not trust or did not think that the Iraqi National Army or the Iraqi National Police or the Shia intelligence service, or largely Shia intelligence service that reports to the National Assembly, would be willing to do, and maybe at least back in 2007 would be too corrupted and compromised to do. So in that respect, if they still think Iran is a wolf with a sled, as to use a Petraeus expression, then they'd like to kind of keep it around a little bit. Though I think everybody recognizes that you can't have this relationship kind of going on, you know, forever. But that's a sticky situation. As for permanent bases, my sense of it is that at the end of the day, I think Maliki wants an air force. An air force for the time being, for at least the medium term, would be an American air force, because there really is the Iraqis don't have the capability to fly the planes. That takes a long time. So, you know, effectively, U.S. Air Force is the Iraqi Air Force at this point, and I think that would probably continue or be enshrined in a SOFA, even though they wouldn't call them permanent bases. And then I think that everybody now agrees. I mean, I think there was a real conflict in 07 when you had, in this country, and I think at the time Maliki supported the surge, that, you know, you couldn't begin withdrawing at that time. But now, you know, you have everybody, including Petraeus, and, you know, everybody on this issue recognizes that you can withdraw more because the situation in Iraq has gotten a lot better, and the capabilities, at least, of the army and the police service have also improved. So you don't need as many troops to bring peace on the streets, so you can have politics.
The only thing that strikes me as just contentious there, or at least something to watch, rather. Petraeus just sped up the redeployment of another brigade out there. There's been some criticism, particularly emanating from Afghanistan, that the withdrawals that he ended up recommending from Iraq haven't kept pace with the American needs in eastern Afghanistan in particular. We've only got the one brigade that's going to be arriving. It's going to be based, my understanding is, basically on the seam between Logar and Ghazni provinces. In Afghanistan, in the east, on fairly near the PAC border, at least. And some, particularly General David McKiernan, who's commander of USFORA, the U.S. Equivalent of MNFI in Afghanistan, the U.S. military command in Afghanistan, just want to see as much as possible, basically leaving Iraq, and coming into Afghanistan to relieve a really underutilized, or rather under-equipped, I should say, sorry, under-equipped command out there. One thing that I got a chance to ask McKiernan some questions not long ago, and something that he kept on emphasizing was that it's time for Afghanistan to no longer become what he called an economy of force mission. And I was recently in Afghanistan, and you can really see...
I saw some of the reporting. By the way, I want to say, Spencer, it was very, very good.
Well, thank you very much, Eli.
And you put your skin on the line, and I respect that. That's right.
As you have in Iraq. And I respect that greatly. Just the only thing that I would say from that is you can really see when there's like one cavalry troop in all of southwestern Paktia, and we're talking about fewer than, you know, not more than 100 soldiers, basically, for a region of just 150-odd square kilometers, just a massive amount of space, 150-odd thousand square kilometers, just a massive amount of space. It's just simply not enough to keep pace with what the needs are there. And so one thing that we're going to be seeing is some tension between how fast you can stick with the SOFA requirements for withdrawing forces from Afghanistan, allow for the dwell time to get particularly army troops rested, trained up, and re-rotated back in and move them into Afghanistan. Right now Obama's talking about 3 brigades, but there's been some reporting over the last 2 weeks that there might be a greater need or might be a greater request put forward from either Petraeus at Central Command or McKiernan at US-4. And
you think Obama's going to want to get his hands, like, particularly dirtied up in the details of this stuff? I mean, if he gets a consensus military recommendation from his generals, and if Biden signs off on it, and Biden is always sort of keen on these ideas as well, I mean, would Obama, like, you know what I'm saying? Do you think Obama's, like, you know, in a position right now where he would say, no, this is, you know, I have a very clear understanding, we've got to do this?
I don't think he would.
Would he overrule his generals, I guess, is my question.
I guess it, you know, it depends how you would find the example of that. But I think for the next year, you've got both the senior leadership of the military at the Pentagon, the service chiefs and so forth, and the combatant command, you know, with Petraeus, you know, in charge there, and then the, you know, Odierno in Iraq and McKiernan in Afghanistan, looking just really wary at Obama and trying to figure out where he stands as a less known quantity on these issues. You'll see people looking for visible signs of like respect, understanding, and deference, and alternatively kind of walking around with chips on their shoulder to see if Obama if Obama will make some move that offends them. That's one of the reasons that a lot of people, particularly around the counterinsurgency community, have been pushing this idea of keeping, you know, Bob Gates on for at least a little while. I personally think that's a good idea, both for the country and for Obama's relationship with the military. Because, I mean, you know, even with the status of forces agreement in place, you know, withdrawing from Iraq is going to be a traumatic event for the United States. Obama's people...
I don't know about that, man.
You know?
No, I mean, I think that Iraq will probably, if it continues to go in the direction it's going and they have more national elections, and I mean, I don't necessarily... I don't think it'll be that dramatic.
Good. You know, all the better. So perhaps that point won't come to pass. But
yeah, and I also, by the way, think that there's going to be some at least training troops. There might and possibly like some sort of overwatch at the end of the day in the SOFA, because, you know, just like our politics and our elections and our politics affect sometimes the public statements that aren't necessarily the same as the private statements. I mean, the same dynamic holds for Iraq. And Maliki, you know, lives in a bad neighborhood. He certainly has an interest in not seeing his country, you know, sort of torn apart by, you know, the forces, whether it be, you know, kind of Iranian-linked militias or, for that matter, al-Qaeda. I think he's got an interest in sort of seeing both of those forces kind of remain at bay. And I think a U.S. troop presence that isn't every day in, you know, in block by block in a very kind of intrusive manner and manning checkpoints, you know, once that becomes, you know, kind of a reserve force somewhere in the country, I don't know. My sense is that eventually I think that Maliki would, if you put him under truth serum, would agree to that.
The test will be what comes out in the SOFA.
Yeah.
The
test will clearly come with that. And here's the real question, though. The lead negotiator right now is Ryan Crocker. Does Ryan Crocker stay under Obama?
Yeah, I have no idea about that. I mean, the interesting thing is that with what Bush wanted the SOFA to look like and the discrepancy between what it does, I think the story is still yet to be written. At least, you know, my understanding of it is inadequate. You know, did Crocker get rolled, or did Crocker basically go on his own, you know, decisions and instructions about what should be in the SOFA? I think the kind of myth of Ryan Crocker I think you would probably agree about this, is overrated. I personally consider Zalmay Khalilzad a better ambassador to Iraq in terms of advancing American interests.
Wow, I completely, totally disagree. I thought Timothy Crocker is so much better than Zalmay.
Okay.
I think Zalmay is like a tragic figure. I mean, he wanted to run for like president of Afghanistan. Like, anyway.
I'm not really sure that's true. But okay, let me move because we're kind of running out of time here.
Yeah, we got to cover a couple things on the future of Obama.
Let me make one that I think will be something to really look at with a great deal of importance, and this will be in a piece that hopefully by the time this Blogging Heads is out, we'll be out at the Washington Independent, which is what happens to this rising group of theorist practitioners who advocate a greater role for counterinsurgency operations inside the military. In particular, I'm going to be looking at where a lot of the scholars around the Center for New American Security, which is a largely counterinsurgency-centric think tank in Washington, D.C., and John Nagle, who is
now retired Army.
One of the leaders of this movement, Nagle got out of the Army in the summer. Are we going to be looking at a Deputy Assistant Secretary of Defense Nagle, or even an Assistant Secretary of Defense for Special Operations, Low Intensity Conflict and Stability Operations?
None of the Petraeus guys who left Petraeus Jedi Council and Inner Circle were political in any way for McCain or Obama during the campaign season?
I would go further than that. I saw when Petraeus gave a speech in October to Heritage, he had numerous opportunities to kind of sort of subtly nudge McCain and help him out a bit. He didn't really seem to take them. In particular, he made a point of saying how important it would be to negotiate with American enemies right at the time that McCain was saying that this was an immature understanding of American national interests, and largely because Petraeus himself has done that. Petraeus's Jedi Council sat down with emissaries from Moqtada Sadr's people and so forth, and they found pragmatic ways forward. And that's one
they
of the things.
They did some other things to Moqtada Sadr's people as well.
And one of the things that will strike me as interesting will be to what degree this worldview, which doesn't really mesh with our conventional understandings of liberal or conservative, and it cuts across a lot of the fractures of the foreign policy debate. Currently finds a voice in the Obama administration, particularly in the Pentagon.
Well, it's funny because I've read your series, The Rise of Counterinsurgency, or your interview with Petraeus. I thought it was innovative to include Sadr in the series. And you've probably covered in more detail this new kind of strategic class than anyone else writing in the English language. Mm. I imagine that there's somebody maybe at Al-Qaeda's like web forums who also covered that. I'm just saying, but like at least in the English language, I think that you kind of own the story, and to your great credit.
Well, thank you.
Or at least among the non-military people. Of course, there's Small Wars Journal and so forth.
Which is invaluable.
If I could make a mild, it's not a criticism, it's just, I think, as I've also written about this new stuff, and I think sometimes there's a tendency to think the new coin doctrine is like largely like chai with shakes that used to kill Americans and now they don't.
No, it's way kinetic. This is violent.
No, I'm saying it's way kinetic. Exactly. It's so kinetic at times that like I just wonder like if through all the euphemisms, if like the American public or the Blogging Heads viewer realizes that a lot of counterinsurgency, to sum up, is sort of it's paying former bad guys to kill irreconcilable bad guys.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of what counterinsurgency cashes out to, as you say, is stripped of euphemism, violent activity, violent behavior. Nearly everyone who's been involved in high levels, or let's not even go high levels. Your strategic corporals and your strategic, privates first class and so forth. Know very intuitively that this is a violent and difficult and confusing endeavor. And the question is, what sort of violence do you employ and how you employ it? It's certainly not a question, as you rightfully point out, of being, coin is this nice and antiseptic kind of warfare. Rather, oftentimes, quite the opposite.
Yeah, it's very bloody. Now, that I think that is a nice segue, because we have about 12 more minutes. I want to get a quick take from you. Mm-hmm. I have been reporting that Bush in July pretty much gave CENTCOM, and at least for Philippines, I now understand it's PACCOM, and it gave the military the authority to make the call themselves when they felt that they had real-time tactical intelligence of the location of an al-Qaeda leader in countries besides Afghanistan and Iraq. Now, we've seen this in Pakistan. We just saw it in Syria. But I wrote, and I'm reporting, and then my sources tell me that this could also apply to a wide variety of countries, from Yemen to Mali to Sudan to possibly even Iran. And that strikes me as having huge implications, you know, as Obama comes into power in January. I mean, this is still the policy.
Yeah, first off, it was a great story. It was a fantastic piece of reporting. And I had many of the same questions when I saw the piece. I think that insofar as the move applies to Pakistan, Obama has this sort of tiered policy. You know, under certain conditions, he's expressed this publicly several times and has since mid-2007, he would allow direct military action taken in Pakistan against the wishes of the Pakistani government. That's really a break glass in case of true emergency. You have to get to many different through many different stages before that happens.
Right.
So it's not like this is his first option or where he goes first. I would imagine if really now the combatant commanders have the authority to execute these kinds of raids or you know using UAV drones equipped with Hellfire missiles or something like that, that's going to be something that I would have a hard time seeing Obama either cancel outright or give a complete carte blanche to the commanders for doing. I would imagine there needs to be, and his people would put together a review or something like that of greater conditions under which this stuff can be actually applied. But I'd be really surprised to see him say, to Petraeus, if you see Osama bin Laden in Pakistan, make sure I'm in the Situation Room and going over the targeting with you before we kill him
right.
or capture him. So I think just as long as one of the things your piece raised, which is an interesting question, is how senior is senior? If we're talking about an intent, you can tell me if I'm not understanding what the actual order is to go after a senior Al Qaeda figure. To what extent does that become the head of an Al Qaeda?
It's also, by the way,
affiliate?
My understanding is it's not just Al Qaeda; it's Al Qaeda and affiliates, which
Well, that's the question.
I have not gotten a straight answer what affiliate means, because one of the things that Bush also did, and I think, and actually, Obama said he supported when he at least went to AIPAC, and in the general, was the listing of the Revolutionary Guard as a terrorist organization. I haven't reported this yet, so I don't know, but, what does Al-Qaeda and affiliate mean? An affiliated group. Does that mean that you can go after kind of a jihadist group that is sympathetic to Al-Qaeda and has maybe put out a statement saying, yeah, we pledge allegiance to Sheikh bin Laden, but it's very, very murky to say what it means. We all know Osama bin Laden and Ayman Zawahiri are in Pakistan, and if there was intelligence about their whereabouts, we would hope that they would be, dispatched with quickly. But it gets very trickier when you get into to other members of the organization. Like, they just on October 31st killed a guy named Hakamiya, and he wrote Myth of Delusion, which I think you're familiar with, right?
Yeah.
Now, Hakamiya was described to me as basically, Brian Fishman for the Counterterrorism Center at West Point wrote a big kind of summary of Myth of Delusion, calling him Al-Qaeda's DCI, his Director of Central Intelligence. Is that guy, what I'm saying, is that guy count as a senior guy? The military clearly thinks he is a senior guy, but what if Hakamiya was in Yemen? You know what I'm saying? I mean, what if he was in Iran? I don't know.
And I would think Yemen would be a really good place to go if I were him or if I were his affiliates.
Right. And the other thing is, once now that AQ Central It's not a surprise to them that special forces and drones are going in and killing them. They're getting better intelligence, apparently. I mean, I don't know. We're not there. It's hard to judge.
I have to say one thing about that, and this is something that I want to actually kind of wrap up with this. I have never been more hopeful about, and I have been not because of Barack Obama. This is something else, but I've never been more hopeful of the prospect of actually winning the war on terror, like winning it, not. You know, muddling through with some successes, but I mean winning it than I am right now. And for that reason, and the reason is basically, first off, over the last couple months in Pakistan, you've reported this, our targeting list in Pakistan has increased to a rather significant way, and that would indicate that we're starting to develop a network of informants. We're starting to develop more robust intelligence than we ever have. Now, you make a fair...
By the way, we can't talk about this on Blogging Heads, but I bet you know, and I bet I know, and I know that Bob Woodward knows, there has been a technological advancement that has made some of this possible as well.
Yes, and what I would...
And we're not going to talk about it on Blogging Heads because me, Eli Lake on the right, Spencer Ackerman on the left, are American patriots, and we want to win the war on terrorism. So guess what, terrorists? You're not going to find out from us what's going on.
But so we've got a greater intelligence piece in. We also have, I think, an ironically favorable development in the rise of a really despicable character named Mullah Massoud, the leader of the Pakistani Taliban. Massoud has been doing in the northwest frontier provinces is basically eradicating the organic Pakistani tribal leadership and religious leadership through violence and replacing it with his own structure. And what does that sound like to you? To me, it sounds like Al-Qaeda in Iraq.
It sounds like the Khmer Rouge.
But I really want to stay with the example of Al-Qaeda in Iraq. This is precisely what basically bad counterinsurgents do. They go into an area with established ways of doing business that go back very, very, very deeply and try and replace them with their own structures. And history instructs us that this is basically fighting a losing battle. And whether it will take, again, not to be euphemistic, American violence or allied Afghan-Pakistani violence to change this around, but the circumstances behind the Northwest Frontier Province rising up against Massoud in some fashion or another, I think, are actually fairly auspicious. And then finally, many senior people inside the Karzai government and now with a joint, what they call mini-jirga in Islamabad, with support also from Saudi Arabia, are talking about the prospects for an actual series of peace negotiations with Taliban elements that can be reconciled. And Petraeus is on board with this. McKiernan, when I talked to him, kind of had to be dragged a little bit reluctantly to it. But this is basically a formula, if it's successful, and it may not be successful, but if it's successful, it's a formula for not just fracturing the Taliban in Afghanistan, but fracturing the support and infrastructure apparatus that bin Laden and al-Qaeda senior leadership have in place to stay alive in Pakistan. And all of this together adds up to at least a better chance than we've seen, I would argue, since 9/11, since Tora Bora, actually win the war on terrorism in a concrete, specific, and graduated way that satisfies the interests of our allies in the region and the interests of in particular, people in the Middle East and Central Asia. And I'm wondering what you think about that.
Well, we are almost out of time, but I pretty much agree with that. I think that it's important to note that in the Afghan reconciliation talks, it's reconcilable Taliban, not leadership of the Taliban, who are seen as sort of reconcilable, similar to the model in Iraq. But I do think that, yes, I agree with you. That's an interesting kind of way to frame it, too, the most optimistic. And we haven't even, by the way, we haven't even talked about Rahm Emanuel, which if I was
I got nothing to say about Rahm Emanuel, man.
I'm just saying, Rahm Emanuel, his father was an Irgun message passer.
Was he really?
Anyway, so take that, you know, anyway.
So Rahm Emanuel.
Yeah, no, you should read the Elizabeth Boumiller
that's great.
New York Times Magazine.
So we can say, we can actually say in an important sense that Rahm Emanuel has palled around with terrorists.
Oh, really? Wow. I think the King David Hotel was a military. It was a military. No, that was a military target because that's where the military headquarters of the British Mandate, or the British military headquarters was in the King David Hotel. So I don't consider Ergun to be terrorist in the same sense as I consider Hamas, but works for me. I don't know. So let me just in light of the fact that you and I both agree that I think it's dark days ahead for Al Qaeda, let me end with a little. This is going out to you, Al Qaeda. Steely Dan, Deacon Blues.
Indeed.
Indeed, they got a name for the winners in the world. Oh well, it's not working anyway. Too bad. So, good dialogue, Spencer.
Good dialogue, Eli. Take care.
Shalom. Okay.